Of possessions, cattle and fat sheep are things to be had for the lifting, and tripods can be won, and the tawny high heads of horses. But a man's life cannot come back again. It cannot be lifted nor captured again by force once it has crossed the teeth's barrier. For my mother Thetis, the goddess of the silver feet, tells me I carry two sorts of destiny toward the day of my death. Either, if I stay here and fight beside the city of the Trojans, my return home is gone, but my glory shall be everlasting. But if I return home to the beloved land of my fathers, the excellence of my glory is gone, but there will be a long life left for me, and my end in death will not come to me quickly.
That's from a speech by Achilles in Book 9 of Homer's Iliad. What makes Homer's epic so enduringly compelling, and who was Homer? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Western civilization hails the Iliad and the Odyssey as seminal poetic works from ancient Greece, exploring human nature in a world of shipwrecks, war, adventures, temptations, and wanderings. How did such impressive poems arise 3,000 years ago? Were these ancient Greek epics written by multiple authors or by one man named Homer? What kinds of uses have later critics and authors made of the Iliad and the Odyssey? Joining us to explore the epics of Homer is Will Brockles, professor of classics at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
The Iliad and the Odyssey, they're so different in so many ways. They seem to have had different appeals to people over the years. What do you think has drawn attention to these epics for so long?
I think the two epics do a good job of capturing a wide range of the human condition, what it is to be human. A lot of that boiling down to how they deal with the choice that Achilles has to make that we heard about from that passage in Book 9. Is he going to stay at Troy and face death in battle in order to win glory? Or is he going to return home and live out a long life? In the Iliad, we have concentrated experience, concentrated around the certainty of death. In the Odyssey, we have a celebration of life, but also the problems of life that so many of us face.
Well, with the Iliad and the Odyssey, one thing I noticed when I was looking on my shelf is how many different translations there are. Some are in prose, some are in poetry. How much do we miss by not reading it in the ancient Greek?
We miss a lot of the music of the verse. I'm using a metaphor there, but of course we miss the literal music as well, because these would have been sung to the lyre. But a lot of the most beautiful phrases come down to Greek formulae that were passed down by bards through the generations, and that gained certain associations both through sound and through sense in those generations.
So by formulas, you mean specific recommendations or traditions having to do with meter and pause patterns and that kind of thing?
Pretty much we're talking about stock phrases that have been passed down through the generations in order to create lines of verse, such as what's often translated as swift-footed Achilles, that you would use at a certain place in the line, not only to fill in the line, but also to conjure up what Achilles was like, his constant nature, in that case, one aspect of it, his physical excellence.
So what does the wine dark sea sound like in Greek?
Oinopoponton.
Which is musical.
It is.
Yeah, so it has a certain ring to it in Greek, which I guess we don't get as much in English.
Now, what's known about the time of, let's take the Iliad, how do we know when this was written and to what extent it's from an earlier oral tradition?
We have indications from the sorts of language that's used as to when this may be from. Richard Janco wrote a very influential study of the language of the epics. And he found that it seems when we look at the way that language changes over time, much as English has changed, ancient Greek also changed over time, that we could pin the Iliad and the Odyssey down to somewhere around the late 8th century BCE. Whether that means it's the Iliad and the Odyssey as we have them, that's a whole other question. But certainly the sort of language that's used in the epics does seem to be from around that time.
Can you tell us sort of the basic story of the Iliad and give me some sense of what you think translates so well over all those centuries, what makes it still seem relevant if you read it in the 21st century, and what maybe seems kind of, you know, far away from us?
Well, of course, those are big questions, and we'll have to lead up to them, I think, with a few passages from the Iliad. The first place you go in an ancient work to find out how the work is orienting you is, unsurprisingly, the first few lines. But in those lines, in particular in ancient works, they set you up with the subject matter and the particular themes that are going to be addressed. So in the Iliad, we have a prologue of 7 lines in which the poet addresses the muse and also gives an idea of what he's going to sing about. And it sounds like this. Sing, goddess, the anger of Peleus's son Achilles and its devastation, which put pains thousandfold upon the Achaeans, hurled in their multitudes to the house of Hades strong souls of heroes, but gave their bodies to be the delicate feasting of dogs of all birds. And the will of Zeus was accomplished since that time when first there stood in division of conflict Atreus's son, the lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. So in those lines, we have a number of things set up for us. First thing that the modern reader might notice is that this is not the story of the Trojan War, which a lot of us are familiar with from films such as Troy. This is, in fact, the story of just a few days from that war, and in particular the story of the anger of Achilles. So it's actually a poem about an emotional state in a certain way, and the consequences of that anger. As it describes at the end of the prologue, the anger results from a quarrel between Achilles and his overall commander Agamemnon, in which Agamemnon confiscates Achilles' concubine Briseis. The prologue also mentions the deaths that make up the majority of the epic, which are also a consequence of that quarrel. Later in Book One, Thetis, the mother of Achilles, who happens to be a goddess, who knows that her son is destined to be short-lived if he remains at Troy, goes to Zeus to strike a deal that Zeus will favour the Trojans while Achilles is withdrawn from battle. And in that way, the Greeks will realise how valuable Achilles is to them. Of course, this leads to enormous suffering for the Greeks because of the actions of Achilles. And often Achilles has come across as really quite petty to people who have read the epic. He seems to be sulking like a little child in certain ways. On the other side of it, though, he uniquely of the characters in the epic, and this is very important for the question that you raised, Emily, seems able to take a broader view of things, to go beyond the usual way of seeing the world that the characters in the epic have, and to have a grander vision. If I may, I can just read one more passage that gives us a sense of what that usual view of the world is in the epic. At this point, we've actually got 2 Trojan warriors speaking to one another. We've got Sarpedon addressing Glaucus, and they are expressing the warrior code whereby you risk your life and in compensation you get all sorts of honours. So Sarpedon says, "Glaucus, why is it you and I are honoured before others with pride of place, the choice meats and the filled wine cups in Lycia? And all men look on us as if we were immortals. And we are appointed a great piece of land by the banks of the Xanthus, good land, orchard and vineyard and ploughland for the planting of wheat. Therefore, it is our duty in the forefront of the Lycians to take our stand and bear our part of the blazing of battle, so that a man of the close-armoured Lycians may say of us, "Indeed, these are no ignoble men who are lords of Lycia, these kings of ours, who feed upon the fat sheep appointed and drink the exquisite sweet wine, since indeed there is strength and valour in them, since they fight in the forefront of the Lycians. Man, supposing you and I, escaping this battle, would be able to live on forever, ageless, immortal, so neither would I myself go on fighting in the foremost, nor would I urge you into the fighting where men win glory. But now, seeing that the spirits of death stand close about us in their thousands, no man can turn aside nor escape them. Let us go on and win glory for ourselves or yield it to others." So there, in a nutshell, you have the condition of these warriors that, unlike the immortal gods, who are quite prominent in the Iliad, to some extent as a foil for the mortals, they are not immortal, and owing to their short lives, they must face death to win glory.
But they, of course, have the possibility of a certain kind of immortality if they achieve glory.
Yes, and of course, that immortality is conferred by epic poetry. It's an extremely important function of epic poetry.
And that's the choice that Achilles is consciously making in the Iliad?
Yes. In the passage that we read at the start of the show from Book 9, Achilles is wondering about that choice. Seeing as Agamemnon has taken away his prize, he suddenly gets to think, well, is there then any point in risking my life in battle? If it's not the case that I'm going to win honour from risking my life in battle, why should I? Eventually, he decides that he will return to battle and indeed does risk his life when he loses his dear friend Patroclus. But up to that point, as I say, Achilles, unlike the other characters, is able to ask these big questions. Partly that's to do with the sort of guy he is. He's physically excellent. He's in many ways mentally excellent as well. Partly that's to do with the situation he's in, that he, unlike all of the other characters in this epic, unlike Sarpedon, unlike Glaucus, knows for certain that he will die at Troy. And that's something that we need to bear in mind as we're reading the Iliad, that this is a poem about somebody who is just about to die. And ancient audiences would know this very well. They knew their Trojan story very well, and much as we do these days as well. And they would know that just a few days after the end of the events of the Iliad, Achilles doesn't die in the Iliad, but they would know that a few days after, he was destined to die. And so that makes his choices all the more poignant, all the more important, and really puts in a very vivid form choices that other people have to make in ordinary life.
What kinds of phrases from the Iliad or ideas from the Iliad have sort of jumped out of the text and made it into sort of basic cultural vocabulary? The way, I mean, certainly with a lot of the Greek figures out of myth, even when you say Achilles, we think of the Achilles tendon, you know, the where he was held.
Not to mention the Trojan horse and those
Greeks
bearing gifts.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And I'm curious with the Iliad, what are the parts that seem to have jumped out of that text into our own basic cultural vocabulary?
I think what's come out of the text is perhaps less the events that have come into wider culture and more the characters that the people will think a lot about. Achilles, who we've mentioned already, and also his opponent Hector, who's a very different sort of character, an excellent warrior in his own right, but very much a family man, which Achilles is not. And Paris, Hector's brother, who's somewhat of a dandy, and another very developed character. Also the rather spiteful bickering of the gods that comes out of it. The particular events that you mentioned, such as Achilles being dipped in the river Styx or the Trojan horse, aren't actually in the Iliad. And of course, those are things that have had a big effect on our culture and that had a big effect on ancient culture as well. That, for instance, the Trojan horse turns up a lot in ancient art. It also turns up in the Odyssey, which is set at a later time than the Iliad. So, yes, I'd say it's more the characters than the actual events that... we remember most.
And we should explain again, it never hurts to repeat, what set the whole thing in motion. Paris steals Helen from Menelaus. Is it that simple?
Yes. And the story goes that among the suitors of Helen, who had been princes from all over the Greek world, that they'd been made to swear an oath that whoever won Helen would then defend, would then be defended by the others if she should be abducted, which was rather prescient.
That's right. Well, kind of an insurance policy.
Yes, but if your daughter is the most beautiful woman in the world, then that's the sort of insurance policy you need. And yes, that sets the whole thing in motion. Again, that is something that is a big part of our culture, but isn't actually part of the Iliad. It's something that has a big effect on the goings on in the Iliad, particularly around Iliad 3, where we have the depiction of Helen and her feelings about what's happened. But again, yeah, it's something that the Iliad remembers rather than presents to us.
And the theft of Helen, is the root of that having to do with this violation of hospitality?
The violation of hospitality is very interesting you bring up, because that's extremely important to the Homeric epics. We're thinking about a time here where life was very uncertain and travel was very difficult. And when you went to a foreign place, you needed somebody to receive you, to feed you, to do everything for you, because there was no other way that you could get by if you were out of your homeland. And so networks of guest friendship were hugely important. And if you violated those norms, then you were really threatening the structure of the society of the time. So these were issues that would have been tremendously important to the audiences when the Iliad and the Odyssey were first being performed, or when poems like the Iliad and the Odyssey were first
And Paris performed. Had been a guest of Menelaus's.
Yes, indeed. So that was for the ancient world a really shocking violation of that relationship. As far as the guest relationship goes, I know we'll speak a little later about the Odyssey. That's tremendously important to the story of the Odyssey, and we get a number of presentations of guest relationships gone wrong.
And indeed.
You can be eaten by your host if you go to the wrong place. So yeah, that's a great fear of people at the time, and the epics were responding to that.
Do you find any humor in the Iliad?
Any humor in the Iliad? Possibly, for instance, in the depiction of Paris, who has a rather sort of wimpy characterization and has to be saved out of battle by Aphrodite and that sort of thing. There's one instance in book 23 where a character slips up on a heap of dung. But in general, the Iliad is not the place where you go for a good laugh. It's a place you go for some very sort of serious examination of the human condition and of human suffering and that sort of thing.
And is there a vision of death and afterlife that emerges from the Iliad? Is there a coherent picture of what one should think about death?
There is a coherent picture in the sense that you know that you're not going to live very long, and you just better make the best of it and live as best you can. It's more in the Odyssey where we get depicted more clearly what we might have to expect after death, that part of Odysseus's journeying takes him down into the underworld, and we actually see what life is like for the dead. And indeed, as you might expect from the approach of the Iliad, what it's like after death is not particularly appealing, that you're basically wandering around mindless until somebody arrives and feeds you a bit of blood, and then you're allowed to talk for a little bit, and that's about it. So
try to put that off as long as possible.
Well, that's one approach.
But then there's the whole glory thing.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. This is the big choice. Are you going to, like Achilles, risk death for glory? Or are you, like Odysseus, instead going to take the other side of the choice presented by Achilles in Book 9 of the Iliad? Are you going to try and win your return home and win happiness at home in a family context? And indeed, yes, live long and happily.
And we're going to follow Odysseus on his wanderings when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Tell me, Muse, of the man of many ways, who has driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Many were they whose cities he saw, whose minds he learned of. Many the pains he suffered in his spirit on the wide sea, struggling for his own life and the homecoming of his companions. Even so, he could not save his companions, hard though he strove to. They were destroyed by their own wild recklessness, fools, who devoured the oxen of Helios, the sun god, and he took away the day of their homecoming. From some point here, goddess, daughter of Zeus, speak and begin our story.
That's from the opening of The Odyssey by Homer. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Will Brockless, and we were talking about the epics of Homer. You said when we were talking about the Iliad that those opening lines often really tell the story. So what do those opening lines of The Odyssey tell us about what we are to expect in this epic?
Again, we're not receiving here from the bard the whole story of Troy. We're hearing about one particular point of it, and it seems to have been a skill that the bards had to pick up at whichever point they needed to. In Odyssey 8, we've got that depicted from the bard Demodocus. And yes, so we've got here from some point in this story begin. In more detail, to look at what we've got there, we've got a reference to the man of many ways, who turns out to be Odysseus, but we're not told until line 21 that that's who this epic is about. Possibly the audiences of the time would be familiar with that opening to the epic, and that maybe that was just the way the Odyssey started. But the fact is, it's left mysterious to start off with. And so this is an epic about mysterious characters and difficulties with appearance and truth and that sort of thing. We've also got references to homecoming and the great difficulty of homecoming that you'd expect after 10 years at Troy, after the wars that Odysseus and other warriors had battled through, that homecoming would be the least of their troubles and they'd just get the next ship home and all would be very simple. But instead, it's an effort, it causes great suffering for them. And as we hear, Odysseus loses all of his companions on his homecoming.
It's a kind of judgmental opening, isn't it, when it says fools about the companions?
Yes, and this is something that perhaps differentiates the Odyssey from the Iliad, that we do have a clear sense of justice. It's rather rough sort of justice in that people tend to get punished in groups rather than looking at what individuals did or whether one individual did worse things than some other individual. But there is a sort of justice. If a group of people does some bad things, like the companions who eat the oxen of Helios, as is referred to in this prologue, they will be punished, and punished really pretty severely. This also prepares us, although they're not mentioned in the prologue, this prepares us for what happens to the suitors. The suitors of Penelope, the wife of Odysseus, later on in the epic, when they are all killed for the fact that they have been abusing the hospitality of Odysseus's household while he was absent from there.
Do we have that element of trickery in both? I know that we've referred to the Trojan horse, which doesn't actually appear in the Iliad, but it seems to me that the Odyssey is full of disguise and trickery. Do we see any of that in the Iliad?
Any such elements are much less prominent. There is the story of a night expedition in Iliad 10, known as the Dolinea, which has a certain amount of trickery and deception in it. Interestingly, the language of that part of the Iliad seems to be somewhat later than the rest of the Iliad. So where critics over time have tended to regard that maybe as something that came into the poem at a later date. So it is possible that even that we don't want to regard as what people were listening to back in the 8th century BCE when they were sitting down to listen to recitals of the Iliad or poems similar to it.
What can you say about the character of Odysseus? You know, you mentioned with Achilles sort of the different sides of his character. Since Odysseus is our sort of protagonist here, what do we make of him as a man?
This is something that we have to discover as the epic goes on. For the first section of the epic, the focus isn't on Odysseus at all, but on his son Telemachus. So he's kept in the background, and Odysseus finally turns up in book five. And his character develops over the course of the epic. It develops through the difficulties that are put in his way from trying to achieve his return homeward. We have a development from a guy who lives by his wits, who was famously cleverest the cleverest of the mortals at Troy, to somebody who looks a bit more like Achilles by the end of it, that towards the end of the Odyssey, he is carrying out deeds of great butchery, very similar to what Achilles does late in the Iliad. And Odysseus, of course, as we've just mentioned, slaughters all of these suitors and in an act of physical prowess, and also not one that you'd typically ascribe to the sort of most cunning of people or what have you. So there does seem to be a change in his character. I think this can partly be put down to the experiences that he faces. We hear a lot about these very sad stories of people who endure traumatic events away from home. Perhaps people have been at war and have endured some very difficult situations. And then they come home, and sometimes the violence of the war comes home with them. And that's partly what we've got here, I think, that Odysseus brings back the Trojan War to his own feasting hall.
He's also, in a way, the prototypical superhero once he gets back to Ithaca, because he disguises himself as a beggar, that he disguises himself,
yes,
in order to kind of get the lay of the land. And then he declares himself as this great warrior by shooting the arrow through the 12 axe handles. And then suddenly, oh my gosh, it's Odysseus. Who else could it be? And then, of course, all hell breaks loose, which is, the pattern that you see right up to this present day with the superhero, where he, is Clark Kent by day and turns into Superman when the occasion calls for it.
Yes, that's a very interesting parallel, that like Clark Kent in his sort of journalist persona, is perhaps a rather unimpressive man, whereas, of course, Superman is more than a man. We get similar development with Odysseus, that he's disguised as a beggar at the lowest level of the society on Ithaca, and eventually he's revealed looking like the immortal gods. The effect, though, is maybe a little different from what we get in Superman, because of course, when Superman is revealed as Superman, we're getting who he really is. he really is this kind of semi-divine being from outer space or what have you. Whereas Odysseus, when in book 23, Athena comes to improve his appearance to make him look like Super Odysseus before he goes to meet Penelope, that's not revealing the real Odysseus. That's revealing, firstly, somebody who looks like the young Odysseus, but somebody who looks even better than the young Odysseus. And this is a guy who must have been in his 40s or 50s and had done a lot of travelling, spent a lot of time at war, and would probably have looked a bit more like the beaten-up old beggar yeah. than the Super Odysseus who gets revealed at the end. So this leaves some problems for the reader, because if that's the final appearance that we're given of Odysseus and he doesn't really look like Odysseus, then it becomes a bit hard to trust appearances in the epic if they never quite settle down into what they're supposed to be.
Well, that's true. He has to prove who he is to, is it Telemachus with the scar with the scar from the confrontation with the boar?
Yes, that's the marker that he uses for a number of people to prove his identity. But it seems that that's sort of the only stable thing about his body in the last few books of the epic.
Can you say something about the female characters running through it? I mean, there's the Circe who turns men into pigs, and there's the sirens that sing and lure men to their death. There's a lot of deadly women running through the Odyssey.
There are. Part of this, I'm sure we can ascribe to patriarchal fears of the powerful woman, particularly if we look at characters such as Circe, who's very much somebody who's outside of Greek society. She lives by herself and she's not controlled by any man and exercises control over any male visitors who turn up there. And her land is very much at an opposite pole to the Greece that would be familiar to audiences of the time. But at the same time, we do have some powerful female characters in the Odyssey who are considerably less troubling. That we have Helen, who entertains Telemachus early in the Odyssey and does a very good job with it. We have Arete, the queen of the Phaeacians, who seems to have a very important place in their society. And more than anything, we have Penelope, of course.
The all-patient, mm-hmm. all-suffering wife.
Yes, well, and she's certainly both of those things. But at the same time, she's, like her husband, she's a very cunning character.
Oh, the tapestry.
She has a ruse of the tapestry, which she claims is actually going to be a shroud for her father in law, and of course, famously, every night she unweaves it so that she can then weave it during the day and try and make it look like she's actually working on it, whereas actually she is delaying the suitor. She's told them, I can't possibly marry any of you folks and any of you young, eligible bachelors from Ithaca and the surrounding islands until I've set up what I need for if my father-in-law should pass away, that's my duty, then I must look to that first before I get married again.
What else is important in terms of looking at the Odyssey and the theme of the return home? Are there passages that you really love?
Well, I could bring up one of the passages from Odysseus's journeying. As seems to be the case in epic poetry, the poets had the choice to either expand on particular episodes or to talk about them in a shorter burst of time. In this particular episode, the story of the Lotus Eaters is relatively short, but it's a very, very memorable episode. Right at the start of Odysseus's journeying, the tale of the journeying, and sets us up with a number of themes that we come to expect in his return home. And this is what Odysseus himself says about it. 9 days then I was swept along by the force of the hostile winds on the fishy sea. But on the 10th day we landed in the country of the Lotus Eaters, who live on a flowering food, and there we set foot on the mainland and fetched water. And my companions soon took their supper there by the fast ships. But after we had tasted of food and drink, then I sent some of my companions ahead, telling them to find out what men, eaters of bread, might live here in this country. I chose 2 men and sent a 3rd with them as a herald. My men went on and presently met the lotus eaters, nor did these lotus eaters have any thoughts of destroying our companions, but they only gave them the lotus to taste of. But any of them who ate the honey-sweet fruit of lotus was unwilling to take any message back or to go away, but they wanted to stay there with the lotus-eating people feeding on the lotus and forget the way home. I myself took these men back weeping by force to where the ships were and put them aboard under the rowing benches and tied them fast, then gave the order to the rest of my eager crew to embark on the ships in haste for fear someone else might taste of the lotus and forget the way home. So in that particular episode, we have the idea of the dangers of a lot of the places that are faced by Odysseus, and we've got one particular danger, the threat that you will lose your memories of your homeland.
And lose your purpose.
Mm-hmm. Lose your purpose and forget your purpose of returning home. Of course, yeah, we have to bear in mind that by this stage, these guys have been away from home for more than a decade, and so they might retain the longing for their homeland, but if we take this as a metaphor for people's experience, it becomes more and more difficult, I guess, the longer people are away from homeland, to really remember what it's like in any meaningful way.
Well, and their identity seems to be in jeopardy. And when they meet various creatures, various types of, you know, unusual things with one eye or with, you know, just all kinds of abilities that are superhuman, it seems to make them question what being human is.
Yes, that's another important threat that's dealt with in the Odyssey, the threat that you will lose your own identity in the course of journeying. And this can go to extremes such as on Circe's island, that they are transformed into pigs. In the Cyclops' cave, they're eaten, obviously the ultimate form of loss of identity. So, yes, there's the threat that you will change, which is borne out, I think, by what we were talking about with the uncertainty of who Odysseus is when he actually gets home. And obviously, his long travels have challenged this notion of any very stable sense of who he is. So you can change. The other thing that can change, actually, is that your home can change, and inevitably it will change. If I might read just one more passage, this passage from Book 13, you'd think this would be a really, really happy moment that Odysseus at this point, after journeying for 10 years, has finally made it home. You'd think this would be a joyful moment, but rather cruelly, Athena comes down and messes with the appearance of the island so that it's so different that Odysseus doesn't even recognise that he is home. And here's what it says. But now great Odysseus wakened from his sleep in his own fatherland, and he did not know it, having been long away, for the goddess Pallas Athena, daughter of Zeus, poured a mist over all, so she could make him unrecognisable and explain all the details to him, to have his wife not recognise him, nor his townspeople and friends, till he punished the suitors for their overbearing oppression. Therefore to the lord Odysseus she made everything look otherwise than it was. The penetrating roads, the harbours where all could anchor, the rocks going straight up, and the trees tall growing. He sprang and stood upright and looked about at his native country, and groaned aloud and struck himself on both sides with the flats of his hands. So instead of rejoicing when he turns up at Ithaca, he takes on the attitude of mourning, like he's just died or somebody very good close to him has died. And yes, this is a trick by Athena, but it also makes the important point that whenever one does go home, and very many of us have moved away from our childhood homes, then things have changed and you cannot go back to the same home. And this is part of the problems of returning that are explored in the Odyssey.
And it reminds me of the poem by Tennyson about Odysseus or Ulysses, where he imagines him at home, very restless, no longer to be going on any travels. The Tennyson poem opens, "It little profits that an idle king by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. I cannot rest from travel." This is a Odysseus, a Ulysses, who is really not so happy to be home after all because he kind of misses the travel. We're going to look at some more modern versions and responses to the Odyssey and the Iliad and ask the question, was there really a man named Homer? When we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Will Brockless, who is telling us about Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey, those two great epics attributed to Homer. But there's some question as to whether Homer was one person or more than one. And I suppose it all what stems originally from just the differences between these two epics?
That's part of what brings up questions for people, that even those people who talk about single master poets, there's a big question of whether these two rather different epics could be the work of the same person. More troublingly than that, we have indications that the two epics could be the work of multiple authors. And this is something that's very difficult for us to get our heads around, because it's kind of intuitive for us nowadays to think of single authors and, oh, this particular work must be attributed to one particular person, I guess connected with our ideas of intellectual property and what have you, but or just the fact that when we pick a book up, it has generally one name on it. Mm-hmm. So There have been some difficulties that have been raised with this. That firstly, in 1795, a guy called Friedrich Wolff felt that the Iliad and the Odyssey showed evidence of multiple authorship, that there were a number of variants and things that didn't quite fit together all that smoothly, and maybe things from different times within that. And according to him, the texts were actually by some late compiler who had put together the works of lots of different authors. And this basically sparked a debate in the 19th century. There were people who thought, oh, well, in that case, we need to pare down these texts to get back to the originals that must have been by this great guy Homer. And so you had people excising huge chunks of text. On the other side, though, and this has been going on all through the recent history of Homeric scholarship, there are other people who said, hey, okay, so there's so some bits might not fit perfectly with other bits, but the fact is that there seems to be some sort of artistic unity to these pieces. So maybe we can think of one particular poet.
Anything to say that it couldn't have been one particular poet at some point, some gaps in the manuscript for whatever reason, then filled in over the years by others or stitched together?
Well, the stitching together point of view has actually rather been moved aside in the 20th century, because these days people tend to think about these poems more in terms of oral tradition. That where in the 19th century people tended to think of many literate poets, in the 20th century, there's important work by a guy called Milman Parry, who analysed the formulaic systems of Homeric verse and said, hey, these are pretty similar to what goes on in other oral traditions, that these are the little chunks that you need to put together poems very quickly in performance. And so where we have suggestions of multiple voices within the text, then that is maybe quite literally multiple voices, that these were a number of performers over time, that eventually coalesced into what we have. Then the question, though, becomes, were they put together in the state that we have by one genius that we would call Homer, which is the position more or less of some scholars, or is it the case that the genius of these texts is really the genius of the tradition, that is many minds working together, and that these evolved gradually over time?
But does it have a pretty strict convention, though, of meter and line length, and is there a rhyme in it? And you mentioned also some of the rhetorical conventions too.
Yes, it's not rhyming verse. So in that sense, it's a little alien to us. It is verse that's basically constructed on long and short syllables, which you get in ancient Greek in what's called dactylic hexameter, which is basically a recurring pattern for each line. And these particular formulae, these particular phrases, bards would learn, and then they'd be able to stick together whole lines reasonably quickly in performance. It's important to point out, though, that not all of what we have of the epics is formulaic. Really, you're talking about a bit over half of it. That there is a fair amount of room for the bards to be quite creative, even at the level of the individual word.
I was taught that Homer was a blind poet, and that the reason that he could have this incredible length of verse was that his blindness gave him, you know, extra wonderful sense of hearing and so on. And is that just anecdotal, great story, but there's no evidence to support the idea of a man named Homer who was blind?
The Greeks were taught that as well. And there is the earliest piece of evidence in a way for that is actually within the Odyssey, that some people, but particularly going back 100 years or so, quite often looked at a portrait of the bard Demodocus in the Odyssey and said, hey, okay, maybe this is a self-portrait of the poet, which isn't impossible that this could be a portrait of a particular bard, or even possibly this is the self-portrait of the sort of persona that you had to take on to tell the epic poets that tonight I'm going to be Homer rather than tonight I'm going to be Elvis, that you just get into those poems. And Demodocus is a blind bard. This seems to be picked up in the Homeric hymn to Apollo, because we didn't just have the two epics, that there are also hymns to the gods that tell stories about the gods that are told in similar language, in similar metrical forms to the epics. And in the hymn to Apollo, the bard describes himself as the blind man from Chios. So if you're going to say all of these poems are by some guy called Homer, then that would mean he's telling you he is a blind man from Chios. And this was certainly something that came into the Greek tradition more and more when, at later periods, you started getting people putting together supposed biographies of Homer like they wanted to do for other figures. But a lot of that is to do with eventually they were in a more literate culture, quite similar to ours, and it made sense to them to have one particular fleshed out figure who was responsible for all these poems, much as the first thing that we think when we come to these poems is, wow, these are such wonderful works. There must be some genius behind these.
Is this the earliest written Greek that we have?
That's a big question, because we don't have very, very early manuscripts of Homer. Indeed, we're looking mostly at what's found in the sands of Egypt from the 3rd century BC onwards, is when we really start getting manuscripts of Homer. The big question is at what point these epics were first written down. If you listen to guys such as Richard Janko, he thinks that these epics were dictated by an oral bard somewhere around the 8th century BCE. Most people, even if you don't go with that theory, which is sometimes called a Big Bang theory of the epics, then people generally think that there were some sort of texts quite early on in the archaic period, sort of 8th to 6th centuries BCE. And then there were, importantly, there were also texts in the 5th century in Athens when there were great recitations of the Homeric poems, and you needed something to refer to know whether people had done a good job, whether they'd stuck to what they should be doing. But yes, it's unknown exactly when these were first written down. What we can say is that they were probably among the first major things that were written down. Apart from Homer, I mean, we have the works of Hesiod, which are also pretty lengthy. But mostly when we're looking at archaic times, we've got nothing approaching the lengths of the Homeric poems. So for some reason or other, and whether they were in the forms that we have them, we're not sure. But somebody or some people had a pretty major undertaking that they took on to get something like the Odyssey and the Iliad down onto whatever they were writing on.
We're almost out of time, but can you say something about the multiple uses of the Iliad and the Odyssey in modern times?
This is a very exciting time to be working on Homer, because not only are there many scholars who are exchanging ideas about it, but there are also many people composing artistic responses to the epics that we've had a number of wonderful films just recently. I'm a big fan of Troy, actually, although most classicists don't like it all that much, because it has quite a sort of mélange of different sort of cultural and historical influences. We've of course got O Brother, Where Art Thou, which did a fantastic job of retelling the Odyssey. We've also had a number of literary responses of great variety. For instance, we've had Christopher Logue's accounts of passages from the Iliad that he picks out particularly important moments and has some very highly wrought poetry there. Zachary Mason's Lost Books of the Odyssey, which came out, I think, 2008, which are basically short stories that are pretending to be ancient versions of stories from the Odyssey, and they're very interesting pieces of work that I highly recommend. And to give another example, we've had Derek Walcott's Omeros, which transplants the poems to the modern West Indies with the fishermen Achille and Hector fighting over the barmaid Helen and colonial forces fighting over the poet's island, St. Lucia, which was known as the Helen of the Caribbean. So it's got a number of levels of the histories of the West Indies blended in there from Walcott, who is very familiar with the classics, having been given a classical education earlier on in his life.
Well, certainly a fun thing to experiment with, isn't it, in a contemporary context? Our guest has been Will Brocklus. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for that next hour of University of the Air.